We're going to be talking about Jonah. And Jonah is one of those books that, at least sadly for me, I think, is that usually gets regulated to children's stories. It just stays on in, like, you know, the 4 and 5 year old class, kindergarten. We talk about Jonah getting swallowed by the whale, and they make a VeggieTales movie out of it. But the book of Jonah, we do ourselves a disservice if that's all we think about the book of Jonah, because the book of Jonah is a theologically deep book and has a lot to say about life. And that's why this sermon is titled, When Life Doesn't Go Your Way, because the book of Jonah is basically Jonah not getting his way the entire time, and in different ways of not getting his way. And that's usually a big struggle that we all go through. Life doesn't go our way for whatever reason, and then we have to figure out, well, what do you do when that happens? So if you haven't already, go ahead. I invite you to turn to the book of Jonah. It's a small book, just 4 chapters, and we're going to skim through the entire thing. But I kind of imagine that most of you know the basic story, so we don't have to read it all. But we'll start with verse 1 of chapter 1. It says, "The word of the Lord came to Jonah, the son of Amittai, saying, 'Arise, go to Nineveh, the great city, and cry against it, for their wickedness has come up before me.' But Jonah rose up to flee to Tarshish from the presence of the Lord." So this is, at this point, this is the first point, and there will be many more, where we kind of laugh at Jonah. Ha ha ha, how funny. He tried to run away from God. I can remember when I was very young in a children's Bible class, and we talked about Jonah, and it's like, well, I've been told from a very early age, God's everywhere. He can see everything, even if nobody else is around. Didn't Jonah know that? Didn't Jonah go to Bible class when he was a kid? So it seems really silly on one hand of, like, Jonah tries to run away from God, but we do that. Every one of us runs away from God. Every time that we do what we know we ought not to do, or we refuse to do what we know we ought to do, in one sense, that is running away from God. God has given us things to do and not do. And when we actively choose to do the opposite, we're no better than Jonah. It's just as foolish as Jonah. Like, we think that God's not watching. Like, we think that God isn't all-powerful and can't see and know that we deliberately do the opposite of what he says. A couple of things to note about this, about Jonah's plan. So Jonah is in the northern kingdom of Israel, and he's told to go to Nineveh, which is that way. And instead, he goes to Tarshish, which is this way. It's in Spain. It was probably the biggest port city in Spain, well, in modern-day Spain. It wasn't called Spain at the time. But it's also like, so if you notice, Jonah not only runs away from God, he completely runs away from God, like almost in the opposite direction, and not just a little ways, but basically to the other side of the world, at least as Jonah knew it. Jonah was so against doing what God wanted him to do, and he tried to do the exact opposite. And that might also explain, or that might also describe us also when we run from God. So the first chapter has Jonah running away. He gets in a boat in Joppa, and they're on their way to Tarshish, and a storm comes up, and the sailors start bailing all the stuff that's in the boat so that hopefully they can survive the storm, and they've thrown everything overboard except for the people. And then they start thinking about, well, maybe we should start throwing some people overboard. And they find Jonah, and they're asking, like, you know, for Jonah's opinion. And Jonah says, well, that's me. I tried to run away from God. And all of these other sailors are not Israelites. They don't worship Yahweh. And yet they're horrified at a prophet of God trying to run away from his own God. And Jonah asked them to throw him overboard, and they do, and then the storm goes away, and as we know, Jonah gets swallowed by a great fish. And I just kind of, I title this portion of the story, "When You Don't Want to Do What You Know You Ought to Do." There are consequences for not doing the things that you know you ought to do. There are, sin has its consequences. And they can be hurtful to yourself. They can be hurtful to other people. You don't intend them to, but that's how it tends to go. And I think we pretty much understand this one, the dangers that surround it. And you might go so far and so far away from God that really bad consequences happen, like getting swallowed by a whale. And that's the next part that we're going to talk about, is chapter 2 of Jonah has a prayer of Jonah in the belly of the fish. But I want you to pay particular attention to verse 17 of chapter 1, the last verse of chapter 1. It said, "The Lord appointed a great fish to swallow Jonah, and Jonah was in the stomach of the fish 3 days and three nights." So that word that says, "The Lord appointed," some versions say prepared. And that's an important word in the book of Jonah because it comes up later in chapter 4 several times. But this is the first instance. The Lord appointed or prepared the fish, right? It wasn't an accident that Jonah got swallowed by the fish. And there was a purpose behind being swallowed by the fish. And in Jonah's prayer, and it's a very, very beautiful prayer, but we don't have time to go through it. But in verse 2, this beginning of the prayer, Jonah describes what it's like to be inside a fish for 3 days and three nights. He says, "I called out of my distress to the Lord, and he answered me. I cried for help from the depth of Sheol, and he heard my voice." Now, Sheol is the Hebrew word for the land of the dead. So what Jonah is saying is that being in the belly of a fish is like being dead. And I haven't personally been there, but I would imagine so. I don't think it would be very comfortable being in the belly of a fish. You probably have digestive juices around on you, burning you. It's dark. It's scary. You're cramped. I couldn't imagine. That sounds like it would be a pretty bad deal. And what I want us to get from here is the idea that, you know, Jonah hit rock bottom, and this is probably about the rockiest of bottoms that you could hit. And he's there for 3 days and three nights in literally the feeling of death, in probably the worst physical pain that one could experience. And Jonah's there as a direct consequence of his own actions. And his prayer is kind of him almost like thinking back about like what he did and what God is doing for him in the belly of the fish. But that idea, this the belly of Sheol, how often have you been there? I mean, not physically in the belly of a fish, but how many times have you felt that? Last week I was at Limestone County Correctional Facility and I preached a version of this sermon to them. And I imagined a lot of them have hit rock bottom, being in prison. And maybe prison wasn't their rock bottom. Maybe some of them are still on their way down. And I've known people that got involved in alcohol or drugs or other things, and they all hit a rock bottom. But one of the things that's interesting about rock bottoms is that there's no way to go but up. And when people hit rock bottom, it's uncomfortable, it's painful, it's probably as bad as dying, and yet it's almost in some ways people need to hit rock bottom in order to start doing the things that they should have done in the first place. It's like a wake-up call. And when you look at what it says about, you know, God appointed a great fish. God appointed rock bottom for Jonah. And And this thing in which Jonah is not comfortable. It's not something Jonah would choose for himself. It's not somewhere that you would want to go on a vacation. It's not what Jonah would ever say, that's where I want to see myself in 5 years. But it was necessary for Jonah. And the thing that is his torment and is like death to him is also his salvation. And that's what rock bottom can be. Rock bottom means that you're not dead yet, and you still have some life to go. And you can go up from here. And so in a weird way, rock bottom can be the worst point in your life, but it can also be this point in which you're saved from your former life as well. I use this example, and it's for me. It's about me, because I think sometimes when we talk about rock bottom, and somebody's going through rock bottom, or they're on their way there, to just talk about it and then say, "Oh, well, you can overcome it," may sound a little bit silly or saccharine. And so I want to share my own story about that. It's about 10 years ago now. And I'm not going to get into all the details. A person who I thought was my mentor turned against me, lied about me to people in the church, sent emails to thousands of people with lies about me, completely, at least in my mind, I was 23 at the time, destroyed my name, destroyed relationships with people that were as close as family to me. He would send me emails, not on a daily basis, but multiple times on a daily basis, taunting me and doing things to make me feel awful and talk about all the relationships that he destroyed in my life. And unlike Jonah, it wasn't my fault. I didn't do anything to deserve it. And yet my life felt like it was crumbling around me, that I didn't have anything left. And I remember one time, I was 23, I remember one time praying to God, just don't let me wake up. And I'm being entirely sincere here, because these are feelings that a lot of people have, and they don't at some point in their life, and it's shameful to sometimes talk about them. But I remember praying to God, just don't let me wake up. I don't want to go on another day. And then I woke up the next morning. And one of those, the thought hit me was, when I woke up the next morning, was, well, if God didn't take my life then, when I begged to not have it anymore, maybe there's a purpose for me to continue on living. And that's the same thing with this fish. It's like, it's rock bottom, it's horrible, it's awful, it's painful, you don't want it, and yet it's been foisted upon you, it's been appointed for you by God so that you can be there the next day. And so rock bottom, and the point I want to make with this point is, rock bottom can be a blessing, even though it doesn't feel like it. Just like this fish can be a blessing, even though it didn't feel like it to Jonah. And if you ever find yourself in that position, if you haven't gotten to that position in your life, know that another day comes, and perhaps rock bottom is just God's way of saving you. So Jonah gets out of the fish, and we go to chapter 3, and he then decides to do the thing that God tells him to do it again, and then Jonah decides to go to Nineveh this time rather than to try going to Tarshish again. And we'll just read verse 3. So Jonah arose, went to Nineveh. This is of chapter 3. According to the word of the Lord, now Nineveh was an exceedingly great city, a 3 days walk. And then Jonah began to go through the city 1 day's walk, and he cried out and said, yet 40 days and Nineveh will be overthrown. And then the people of Nineveh believed in God, and they called a fast and put on sackcloth from the greatest to the least of them. And when the word reached the king of Nineveh, he arose from his throne, laid aside his robe from him, covered himself with sackcloth, and sat on the ashes. And he issued a proclamation, and it said, "In Nineveh, by the decree of the king and his nobles, do not let man, beast, herd, or flock taste a thing. Do not let them eat or drink water, but both man and beast must be covered with sackcloth, and let men call on God earnestly, that each may turn from his wicked way and from the violence which is in his hands. Who knows, God may turn and relent and withdraw his burning anger so that we will not perish." And when God saw their deeds, that they turned away from their wicked way, then God relented concerning the calamity which he had declared he would bring upon them, and he did not do it. But it greatly displeased Jonah, and he became angry. Okay, so I think we need to step back and talk about the relationship of Nineveh to the northern kingdom of Israel from which Jonah comes from. At the time, when God tells Jonah to go to Nineveh, Nineveh is the capital city of the Assyrian Empire. And at that point in time in history, the Assyrian Empire was the largest empire that the world had ever known up to that point. And the Assyrians didn't get there by peacefully bringing people into their empire and encouraging people. The Assyrians were bloodthirsty murderers. They went into smaller nations. They destroyed them. They would take people from one land, move them across the Assyrian Empire to a completely different land, and then take those people from that land and move them across to another part of their land so that the conquered peoples of the Assyrian Empire would not be able to raise a resistance against the Assyrians. The Assyrians were seriously awful people. Bloodthirsty, violent, vile people. And Jonah came from one of those small little countries that actually Assyria would eventually do that very thing to. Assyria, a few generations later, would defeat and destroy the northern kingdom of Israel and displace the people in other parts of the Assyrian Empire. So Jonah, as a man from the northern kingdom of Israel, would look at Assyria and look at their violence and look at the way that they treated small nations and rightly think that they are the bad guys. And Jonah's told to go preach to them. And so maybe you can understand on one level like why maybe Jonah's a little hesitant to go, because this is not only hostile territory, but these are evil people. And yet Jonah decides to go after, and so that explains the whole first two chapters of Jonah. But Jonah goes now, and he preaches a one-sentence sermon, which right now might be sounding pretty good to some of you out there. A one-sentence sermon, and that's all that it says that he preached. 40 days and Nineveh will be overthrown. He didn't even give them an invitation. And yet, the entire city repented up to the king, and they prayed to God, and did you notice the king's attitude? That the king didn't even presume that repenting would turn away the wrath of God. He just says, perhaps it might. That's a humble man right there. That's a humble and contrite man. And the whole city does that. And God does relent from the destruction of Nineveh. And the whole city of Nineveh repents. And yet, as we saw in verse 1 of chapter 4, Jonah didn't like it. And what strikes me about this is that if you were to ask any preacher about wanting to be effective, right? One sentence, the largest city in the world at the time completely repents. I would say that's a pretty good job, right? Preachers, that would be the height of what it could mean to be a preacher. One sentence, the whole city repents. Jonah was efficient and effective, and more effective than probably almost anybody. And yet Jonah didn't like it. And this is what I talk about, or this point, I call this, when you do the right thing, but you don't feel good about it. And that might seem a little counterintuitive, like when would you ever do the right thing and not feel good about it? And I'm going to give a few examples. First, a kind of silly one, and then a more serious one. The silly one is okay, you're at work, and there's a guy who's making your life miserable. He's talking about you behind your back. He's sabotaging your advancement opportunities. He'll talk to the boss and convince the boss to give the promotion to him instead of you. And you know, and he hides things from your desk, and he makes your life miserable. And it's so annoying that you want to lash out. You want to yell at him. You want to maybe smack him, but HR would get you in trouble with that and all that other stuff. But then you go to the Bible and you say, well, Jesus did say to turn the other cheek. And there is that part in Romans where Paul says, well, if your enemy's hungry, give him something to eat. And if your enemy's thirsty, give him something to drink. And in so doing, you'll pour hot coals on his head. And then you're thinking, well, this guy deserves some hot coals. So we're going to kill him with kindness. And so every false smile that you give him, every kind word that comes out of your mouth, that's hard to do, but the Bible told you it's the right thing to do, so it's the good thing to do, and you're doing the right thing, and you're doing this for a few months, and it's hard, but you're going to do it anyway, and you're just imagining those coals just heaping up on his head. And then one day he comes over to you and he says, you know what, I've been thinking, you know, I've been treating you so poorly, so awfully, and all the time you just smile at me, you do nice things for me, you've never retaliated against me. You know what? I'm sorry, and I'm going to try to be better. I'm not going to do the things that I was doing to you anymore. I hope we can mend fences and repair our relationship. And then after he says that and he walks out, all you can think is, that jerk. Because now I have no good reason to be mad at him. He apologized to me, and I'm still mad at him. And that's how I almost sometimes I feel, is like, I want to just feel mad and feel righteous in my, you know, being nice to him. Now I've got to really be nice to him. And so that's maybe doing the right thing and not feeling good about it. But a more serious example. So maybe a guy gets his girlfriend pregnant, and maybe his first thought is to, you know, to ditch her and the kid, to run away, to just abandon the family that he started. But he thinks better on it. Maybe he marries her. He sticks with her. He decides to be the father and husband that he became, and he raises his child, and then. But in doing that and being respectable in that way, he can't hang out with his buddies anymore. And raising a kid has its own problems. The kid, you know, keeps you up. It has needs. You have to spend money on it instead of on yourself. And maybe a father in that position might start wondering, well, did I make the right choice? Did I do the right thing? And they did the right thing, because just in the fact of having two parents raise a child makes it so much more likely that that child will succeed as that child grows up. And in our country, so many more children are going without fathers, that just by being there, the father is doing a great service to his child that not every child and a lot of children don't get in this country. And yet, it might feel, at times, you might feel empty. You might feel like, why am I doing this? I'm not having fun. And you might start pining for the days when things were better. So this isn't a completely foreign concept, to not feel good when you do the right thing. And you might feel empty inside. So what are we missing if we feel that way sometimes? I want you to hold on to that thought about, like, what's missing when you do the right thing and you still feel bad? What's missing? Because this goes into the next section in chapter 4. In chapter 4, it says in verse 2, Jonah prayed to the Lord and said, "Please, Lord, was not this what I said when I was still in my own country? Therefore, in order to forestall this, I fled to Tarshish, for I knew that you are a gracious and compassionate God, slow to anger and abundant in loving kindness, and one who relents concerning calamity. Therefore, now, O Lord, please take my life from me, for death is better to me than life." So Jonah says, I didn't want to preach to the Ninevites because I knew that they would repent, and I knew when they repented that you would forgive them. And Jonah kind of sounds like that first silly example. It's like, I knew that they would turn right, and I didn't want them to because I want to keep hating them. And so Jonah's so angry, so displeased, that he prays to God to just let me die. And then God says, "Do you have good reason to be angry?" And I'm reading from the New American Standard, and I don't quite like the way that they render that. In some other versions, God says, "Do you do well to be angry? Do you do well to be angry?" And so this is interesting to me because God doesn't chastise Jonah. God doesn't say, "Jonah, well, now you know, it's better that people repent and, you know, that I'm a loving God." And he doesn't start like giving Jonah the rundown. He just asks Jonah a question. And he lets Jonah sit with it. And then it goes into verse 5. Jonah went out from the city and he sat east of it, where he made a shelter for himself and sat under it, and the shade under it, sat under it in the shade until he could see what would happen in the city. So Jonah is kind of hoping maybe God will change his mind. Maybe the city won't, like, will go back like immediately after he leaves the city, maybe. So the Lord God appointed, and there's that word again that I told you to remember about the fish. God appointed or prepared a plant, and it grew up over Jonah to be a shade over his head to deliver him from his discomfort. And Jonah was extremely happy about the plant. But God appointed a worm. That, again, appointed a worm. And when dawn came and the next day, it attacked the plant and it withered. And when the sun came up, God appointed a scorching east wind. And the sun beat down on Jonah's head so that he became faint and begged with all his soul to die, saying, "Death is better to me than life." So I want you to, so this is also like another point where we think, man, Jonah's pretty silly. Why would a plant dying make Jonah suicidal? Like, why would Jonah want to die? It's just a plant, Jonah. Get over it. And even when you go into, God said to Jonah, "Do you do well to be angry about the plant?" And Jonah said, "I have good reason to be angry, even to death." Jonah argues back with God. He says, "Yes, I have anger. I'm angry enough to die." And that might seem silly, but I want you to think about this. Jonah has gone through a pretty horrendous set of affairs in his life recently. We might call that in modern parlance stressful. Jonah's had a pretty stressful set of events. And now the city, his enemies, are going to be saved from destruction. He's not going to get anything that he wants. He's gone through all this trouble of running away and being swallowed by a fish and coming back and preaching a sermon that he didn't want to preach. And now the thing that he wanted to happen isn't going to happen. And he goes out into the city and he's miserable. He's angry. He wants to die. And he sits under a plant, and there's a little bit of shade. And you know, on a hot day, when you find some shade, that can be a glorious thing, right? Shade, you know, it's, Jonah has been in an uncomfortable situation, and now he's found just a modicum amount of comfort, just a little bit of something to just ease his suffering for a moment. And God sent it to him. Notice that I said that. God appointed or prepared that plant. God gave the plant to Jonah. And Jonah is in this moment of just of comfort from all the suffering that he's gone through. But then God appoints a worm to kill the plant. And so God takes away the thing that he gave to Jonah. And then God appoints a scorching east wind to remind Jonah that he doesn't have the plant anymore. And in this moment, it seems that God's being some kind of cruel, arbitrary dictator over Jonah's life. Why would God give Jonah a plant just to take it away and then to rub his face in it with an east wind? And when you think about this, is like the plant was like the last bit of comfort in Jonah's life, and it was taken away from him, and now he has nothing to comfort himself. And maybe this is the point at which you start realizing that that kind of makes sense why you'd get angry. Because we have things in our life that give us comfort. And, the plant's a metaphor for our lives. It's the relationships that we have. I want you to think of the things that give you true comfort in this life. It's, the relationships with your family, with your spouse, with your children. Maybe you found a job that you find really fulfilling and it makes you feel like you're making a difference in the world. Or maybe it's just like those moments where you just get to sit down and rest in the air conditioning for a little while and it feels like, even though a lot of things are going wrong in the world, it feels like, at least right now in this spot, I'm good. God gives us all those things, and God takes them all away. Because the thing that is consistent among all of those things in this world, the things that give us comfort in this world, they are not destined to last. They are all going to go away. You will die or they will die. Things, Jesus puts it, thieves will come in and steal, and moths will destroy, metal will rust. All these things only have a certain amount of lifetime. And God points that out in verse 10. God said, "You had compassion on the plant for which you did not work and which you did not cause to grow, which came up overnight and perished overnight." God's telling Jonah, a plant has a limited lifespan. It's not going to last forever. You know that this is temporary. And I think a lot of times the things that we're, and this section is, when the things that give you comfort are taken away from you. And we think that, and it's not an unreasonable emotional response when a loved one dies or you contract a disease that keeps you from doing the things that you want, or just the process of getting old and not being able to do the things that you used to be able to do. The very things that give us comfort are taken away from us. And in one sense, you could say that they come and are taken away from the same source. God gives and takes away. And that can seem like a very cruel thing on its surface. And you can understand, and people get reasonably angry at God, at life, at themselves, at other people, when the comforts of life get taken away. But God points out to Jonah that these things were never going to last forever. And in some ways, maybe we shouldn't expect them to. If you would, I know I've been going a little long. I just got a couple more things. If you would, turn to 2 Corinthians. Because I want to bring this idea of temporary and physical into a New Testament context. 2 Corinthians chapter 4, Paul's talking about the suffering that we can experience as Christians. So suffering that's not of our own fault, but suffering nevertheless. And in verse 16 of 2 Corinthians chapter 4, Paul says, "Therefore we do not lose heart, though our outer man is decaying," right? We're getting old. We're dying. Everything around us is decaying as well. The things of this life are not set to last forever. So we do not lose heart, even though our outer man is decaying. Yet our inner man is being renewed day by day for momentary light affliction. So what does Paul mean by momentary light affliction? He's talking about this life. This life, no matter how much suffering it is momentary and it is light affliction. Because when you compare it to what is on the other side, this momentary light affliction is producing for us an eternal weight of glory. I want you to think about that. The suffering that we can go into this life can feel heavy and can feel like there's no way out. But Paul says, compared to the eternal, that means it's never going to die. That means it's going to last forever, unlike everything in this world. And he calls it the eternal weight of glory. It has substance. It's real. It's not going to go away. The eternal weight of glory far beyond all comparison. When you think about that, anything in this life is a momentary light affliction. A thing it doesn't last for eternity. And he says in verse 18, while we look not at the things which are seen. He means this world, the things that we can see. But this is where our senses usually betray us, because we think we can, because we can touch it, because it's here, because it gives us physical and emotional comfort, we think it's supposed to last forever. But it doesn't. The things that are seen, we look not at the things which are seen, but at the things which are not seen. For the things which are seen are temporal. Everything is temporal that is seen, but the things which are not seen are eternal. And I'll bring this back again to Jonah, because this is the last point that God makes. Should I not have compassion on Nineveh, the city in which there is more than 120,000 persons who do not know the difference between their right hand and their left, as well as many animals? God says there's something more important than petty politics. And the Assyrian Empire conquering nations and displacing people on the grand scale of things is petty politics when compared to the souls of people. And God is saying, shouldn't I have compassion on these people who don't even know the difference between the right hand and the left? They don't even, like, God is saying, is like, they're like children. They don't even know the difference between right and wrong. Maybe a lot of what they're doing is wrong is that they just don't know. And God asks that, should I not? Should I not? So a lot of this stuff, these things we talked about, you know, not feeling well when you do the right thing, or feeling awful when comfort is taken away from you, part of it is backing up and changing our perspective. That the suffering in this life is suffering, but it's temporary. And if we are aligned with God, then there's something better. And there's something better that's being produced from our suffering. And then just quickly, the last point. The book of Jonah ends like no other book in the Bible. In fact, not like most any other book of antiquity, and not even like most of our books produced today. The book of Jonah ends on a question. We never know what Jonah does after this. And if a modern English professor were reading this, they'd think that this was a very postmodern way to end a book, because it doesn't have an ending. And maybe sometimes, and we love endings because we want to know what happens. Like if a TV show ends just on a blank screen, like, I never watched the series, but I know that The Sopranos did that. Like, it just ended on a blank black screen, and a lot of people didn't like it. Because we want resolution, we want an ending. And yet the book of Jonah doesn't have one. The book of Jonah doesn't end the way we want it to. And things don't always end the way that we want them to. Things don't always have clear and clean endings. And we want that from sermons as well. Well, I'm not going to give one to you. Instead, I'm going to end it with the question that God gave to Jonah. When you're feeling angry at the world for whatever reason, because of you want to do what God's told you not to do, because you've hit rock bottom and you're suffering in this life, maybe you've tried to do the right things and it feels empty inside, or maybe something that has given you comfort is or has been taken away from you, and maybe that makes you feel angry and distressed and everything else. And that's true. The question to leave you with is, do you do well to be angry with that? And with that, I will end. Thank you for your attention.